I want to introduce our next speaker. Beth Allison Barr is the James Vardaman Professor of History at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. She specializes in medieval history, women's history, and church history. And she is the author of the USA Today bestseller, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth. And I highly recommend that book. And then she has also authored The Pastoral Care of Women in Late Medieval England, and the forthcoming book, How Marriage Replaced Ordination as Women's Path to Ministry. And I'm anxious to see this one, since my mother was a pastor's wife. I think one of the interesting things that Beth brings to us, too, is she has been able to move into that public scholar role in many ways. So her work has been featured on NPR and The New Yorker, and she has written for such a broad range of different publications, from Christianity Today to The Washington Post, MSNBC, The Dallas Morning News, and Sojourners. I find her work to be powerful in its ability to use history to help us reflect on the present narratives that shape us. And her work has even influenced my work on the history of women in the ASA. It's provided some historical context for that. And she also shows how faith journeys and life experience can shape the questions that God gives us to ask. So welcome, Beth.
I have to tell y'all, I keep thinking after each plenary, gosh, that's going to be a hard one to follow. And that has only grown. And following that sermon this morning, that was really, really incredible. So I just want to say thank you for inviting me here. When I told my father is a physician, he's also a medical researcher in Texas for the NIH All of Us program. And he sort of keeps up with where I'm speaking. And he asked me, he was like, well, what are you doing in DC? And I said, well, I'm speaking for the American Scientific Affiliation. And he was like, do they know you're a medieval historian? And I was like, yes, they know I'm a medieval historian. And he was like, oh. He was like, well, why are you speaking at the ASA? So for those of you who are wondering, and maybe some of you have just now realized that I'm a medieval historian, and you're too beginning to ask those same questions, maybe let me give you a little bit of background about why I think I'm here. I am a medieval historian. In fact, I've decided that the research triangle is really well represented at this conference because we've had a professor from Duke, and then two people, Francis Collins last night and myself, are both graduates of Chapel Hill. So I feel really good about representing the research triangle right now. I'm also a scholar who is of faith. I am an evangelical Christian. In fact, I don't have a profound conversion story because I don't remember a time in my life when I did not know about the love of Jesus. I grew up in a household that believed. I grew up with strong faith, with my grandmother's faith and my mother's faith. And it never questioning the reality of Christianity and the love of Jesus was never a problem that I have faced. The problem that I have faced is more within the church. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I grew up Southern Baptist, and those of you who have been paying attention, maybe some of you also grew up Southern Baptist, and those of you who have paid attention at all to the news know that the Southern Baptists are frequently in the news. mostly not for good things. And they are, and some people are very concerned about how much airtime the Southern Baptists get. And while that's fair, at the same time, y'all do know that the Southern Baptist is the largest Protestant denomination in North America. And at one point in time, it claimed over 16 million people. Now it has sank to a little below 13 million. But nonetheless, it is still a powerhouse in the evangelical world. It never actually joined the, the Evangelical Association, because Southern Baptists always think they can do it all on their own. But it still has been a very heavy influence within the evangelical world. And I am also married to a pastor. In fact, right now, my husband is preaching at our small church in Waco, Texas. So I have that experience that many of you have had of being a person of faith within the church as the same time that we are also academics working in the much broader world of our scholarship. And in 2021, in sort of an act of desperation, that's really how I describe it, I wrote a book called The Making of Biblical Womanhood. And this book combined my experience as a woman of faith in the conservative evangelical world and my knowledge as a medieval scholar. And although I didn't mention this phrase in the book, in many ways, The Making of Biblical Womanhood tackles the question that is the title of my lecture. The question, are women human? Now, I'm sure for many, I'm struggling a little bit here because I'm a talker and I walk around and I'm trying to stay behind the microphone. So, you know, I have to keep reminding myself to stay here. But the question for many of you who hear this question, are women human? It may not seem like a real question, right? I mean, yes, of course women are human. As I'm speaking to a room of people who are in the field, many different fields of science, there is no question that the biological, from biological definitions, as well as genetics, et cetera, women are clearly human. But for others of you in the room, for those who landed an early career job after long years of graduate work, and found that a male colleague hired in a parallel position with a similar CV started at a higher salary than you and with more startup money for his lab. For those of you who have experienced a disconnect between being a leading scholar in your field and being barred from leadership positions in your church simply because you are a woman. For those of you who have felt a call to ministry only to be told that God placed limits on that calling, as the 1984 Southern Baptist Convention resolution at Kansas City stated, women were first in the Edenic fall and therefore cannot be pastors. For those of you who have struggled with self-worth in the church, as a single woman, or a woman facing infertility. For those of you who have found yourself Billy Grahamed, if you know what that means, the Billy Graham rule, which is the rule that was put out in very good faith by Billy Graham and the members on his team to always be above reproach by not meeting separately with women. and probably had no idea how that rule would be enforced, not only in the church, but in the workplace for women, and barring women from joining in lunch meetings with their male peers or going to conferences with their male peers and being excluded from those networking conversations because their male colleagues want to be above reproach. For all of you who have experienced any of those things, I bet this question resonates. Are women human? This question, if you don't recognize, I had dinner last night with someone that I sat with, and I'm trying to remember her name, but it was really fantastic because she was like, is the title of your talk from Dorothy Sayers? And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so impressed that you know who Dorothy L. Sayers is. For those of you who don't know, she's a British scholar who is also actually a medievalist, okay? It's one of the reasons why I resonate with her. And she's a Christian intellectual. She's also a writer of popular detective fiction. And so some of you may have read, like, she's most well known for what's called the Peter Wimsey series. But nonetheless, Dorothy L. Sayers is actually the inkling who often does not get mentioned. And if you're in literary circles, you know who the Inklings are, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and all of that group. And Dorothy L. Sayers was actually part of that same time. She's one of the very first women to get a degree from Oxford, which is a whole fun story in of itself. She earned her degree in 1915, but was not awarded her degree until 1920, because that's when Oxford first started giving women degrees. I mean, it's sort of like Southern Baptist seminaries today. They took women's money, but then wouldn't give them the degrees or wouldn't give them the titles. But by 1920, Dorothy L. Sayers graduated from Oxford, and she entered into the writing world. She became an editor and a publisher, and then she started writing her own texts. As I said, she sort of kicked it off. She was a very good short story writer, detective fiction writer, but she also was a Christian thinker. And indeed, we have a whole series of her letters with Christian intellectuals, including C.S. Lewis, who was one of her good friends, pen pals. And one of my favorite things about Dorothy L. Sayers is that she always tells C.S. Lewis what she thinks, which is just really fantastic. And in 1938, she presented a talk to a woman's group. And the talk that they invited her to come and talk about what she did as an author, et cetera. And she was a little annoyed by several things that were going on in England at the time. And so instead, she presented a talk that I think probably surprised them all. And the title of her talk was, Are Women Human? And this is what she argued in that talk. She said, look, we should stop always categorizing women by their biological difference from men, instead of first approaching them as humans who are the same as men. She writes, quote, a woman is just as much an ordinary human being as a man, with the same individual preferences and with just as much right to the tastes and preferences of an individual. When we isolate and objectify women, like I was reading in the ASA history, that there was a time when this conference always referred to the lady scientists, okay, this is this objectifying women because of their sex. What we are doing is we are categorizing them as different from men, as less human than men. As Sayers continued, it is my experience that both men and women are fundamentally human, and that there is little mystery about either sex except the exasperating mysteriousness of human beings in general. When Sayers was asked how she wrote male conversations so well, even though she was a woman, she responded that she simply wrote men like the ordinary human beings they were, quipping that, quote, women as well as men, when left to themselves, talk very much like human beings too. Women foresayers were human and deserved to be treated as much. One of my favorite letters that Dorothy L. Sayers wrote to C.S. Lewis was in 1948, when he reached out to her for help. He was concerned about the Church of England's movement towards ordaining women, and he wanted Sayers to use her influence as a respected Christian intellectual to stand with him against female priests. He wrote, "The defense against the innovation must, if possible, be done by a woman." And I really loved his admittance of using women to keep women from being able to move into leadership positions. This is still something I always call it, the token women who get pulled up by, you know, the Gospel Coalition and various things to write about why women should not be leaders. I have a great deal of empathy for those women. And Dorothy L. Sayers told C.S. Lewis no. She said, "Look, I feel you would find me an uneasy ally, because I can never find any logical or strictly theological reason against women's ordination. Insofar as the priest represents Christ, it is obviously more dramatically appropriate that a man should be, so to speak, cast in that part. But if I were cornered and asked point blank whether Christ himself is the representative of male humanity or of all humanity, I should be obliged to answer, of all humanity, and to cite the authority of St. Augustine for saying that woman is also made in the image of God." End quote. God created woman fully human, Sayers believed, which means that women, as co-equal heirs with men, as members of the same body of Christ, in which Paul warns us that no member should be thought of as better than another. Sayers argued that women should not be treated as less than men. And she cited Augustine as the authority for her view. Now, as a medievalist and a women's history scholar, I find this choice fascinating. I think Sayers was playing to her audience by choosing Augustine, because for those of you who have read C.S. Lewis, you know that he draws significantly from the works of Augustine to influence his own theology. And so Sayers was saying, "I'm disagreeing with you, and even this church father who you have relied upon argues that women are made in the image of God." Now, Augustine made a lot of other problematic things about women, but nonetheless, he did say that. But at the same time, even though Sayers used the words of Augustine to combat C.S. Lewis, I can't help but wonder how much her knowledge of medieval Christianity, especially medieval sermons, influenced her view on women. Now, as I said, I am a medieval scholar. One of the reasons that I first fell in love with Dorothy Sayers was because if you read through her any of her works, you find that she quotes a lot of people that you won't recognize. And a lot of those people that she quotes are actually 15th century sermon manuscripts, which is really cool for somebody who works on 15th century sermon manuscripts, okay? So I thought I'd show you a little bit of my scholarship that I do. This is my data that I work on, the type of things. I had a lot of these, but I cut it all down to one. But this is the type of data that I work on. And these manuscripts, one of the great things about working in the British Library Archives and actually throughout England is that they keep lists of all the people who have worked on these manuscripts. And so it was really fantastic to walk in and see these manuscripts and know that Just a few years before me, a woman named Dorothy L. Sayers had read these same texts. So I can stand here and tell you that I know she read the same texts that I now read because we have her name listed with them. And so what I want to do for the next few minutes is I want to show you what Dorothy L. Sayers would have learned about how medieval Christianity saw women. Because I think there's a lesson in that for those of us in the modern church, especially the evangelical church. Now, I know what a lot of you are probably thinking, and that is, if you had to think about the medieval world and the medieval views of women, thinking about them as being pro-women, or even the word feminist, would not be applicable, right? And that's true. I mean, the medieval world, their concept of how male and female bodies worked was built on the Aristotelian model, okay? And I'm just summarizing. I'm not going to walk through this all for you. We could have one of the things I've had to do at Baylor in the past is I've had to help the medical humanities program in talking about the medical history, because we still don't have a history of medicine. If you know of anybody, we're looking for a history of a person who does the history of medicine. But nonetheless, I've had to fill in a little bit on that. And the students in those classes are always fascinated to learn that the way that medieval science worked about the body was based upon this classical model that the body is composed of four different humors, and that the way to stay healthy is to balance those humors. And there are really two different types of humors. There are ones that are hotter, and there are those that are colder, hotter and drier, and colder and wetter. Okay. And it was believed that the male body was hotter and drier, okay, which made the male body more active than the female body, which was colder and wetter and was seen as more passive, okay? This also played into their understanding of the generation of humanity, of conception. And they believed that even though both women and men participated, obviously, in the creation of children, that only the man actually gave the life-giving force, the active force that was able to generate life. Women only contributed the matter, okay? We gave the substance, you know, that unformed stuff that then needed that light spark, that life spark from the man, for it to become life, okay? The example that Aristotle uses is of a carpenter, that you have all of this wood, this material, but it's not until the carpenter comes in and makes it into something that it becomes usable. And so the woman is the wood, and the man is the carpenter, okay? You can see this. And this framework gave the framework for, and I've summarized a lot of different points that Aristotle has made in a lot of his writings. And he says things like this. He says, look, women, the courage of a man lies in commanding, a woman in obeying. Okay? This sounds a whole lot like some of our theology in our modern churches. He says that a woman is an incomplete male. He actually uses the word deformed, okay? And also that a woman is an inferior being. And then my favorite, he warned his fellow writers of tragedies and comedies, etc. He said, don't make your female characters too clever or brave, because that does not fit with who women really are, okay? In a word, the medieval world is what we would call patriarchal. Now, I'm just going to pause here for a minute and praise Barbie. I don't know how many of you have seen the Barbie movie, but it has made my life as a women's historian who has to teach freshmen what patriarchy means. It has just made my life so much easier. I used to have to spend so much time explaining and even trying to convince students that patriarchy actually existed. And now all I have to do is direct students to YouTube clips of the matriarchal Barbie land with Ryan Gosling singing, "I'm just Ken, doesn't matter what I do, I'm always number two," okay? Or show them a clip of Ken living it up in the Mojo Dojo Casa House in Kingdom after he wrests control from the Barbies, overturned their matriarchy and set up his own version of patriarchy, which, as a medieval historian, I really appreciate his fixation on horses and fur cape. So the medieval world, beyond doubt, is what we would describe as patriarchal, okay? And I have the definition here, a pretty accepted definition, that a society is patriarchal to the degree that it is male-dominated, male-identified, and male-centered. Core cultural ideas about what is considered good, desirable, preferable, or normal are associated with how we think about men and masculinity, which is why people writing y'all's journal once used to qualify scientists that were women, instead of just describing them as scientists, describe them as lady scientists. Because the norm, when you just said scientists, the norm was male scientists. But you don't have to qualify that because they're male, and male is the norm. But when it's a woman, you have to qualify that because that is not the norm. You see this? Okay? That's a patriarchal society. Okay? The medieval world, beyond a shadow of a doubt, was patriarchal. Which is why, you know, I think it's the medieval world did things like their economic system. I know this is really going to surprise y'all because it's but you know, I hate the word dark ages for the medieval world, but it's such a dark age concept. And did you know that women in the medieval world who worked in exactly the same types of jobs as men got paid less? I mean, can y'all imagine a world that would pay somebody less for identical labor just because of their biological body? I'm sure we can't imagine that at all, especially not in STEM. Not in the humanities either, but you know, humanities professors are already paid so low that there's often not as much of a discrepancy, but there you are. Okay. So, the medieval world, I'm not standing here before you and telling you that the medieval world was a golden age of egalitarianism. Egalitarianism is a modern concept, just like complementarianism is, okay, which I'll talk about in just a moment. Yet, the medieval world left room for women in a way that we often do not find in especially our modern churches. So let me just show you a little bit, and I'm going to go quickly through some of this. Again, these are this is the evidence, the type of manuscripts that I work on, okay? This is one of the most popular medieval sermon compilations in late medieval England. It was copied more than 40 times. It exists in more than 40 manuscripts still today. It was also printed all the way up through the Reformation era, and in fact, the last known preaching of John Mark's Festial was in 1581. Okay, so this was a very, very popular sermon text. So this is one of the ones that I work on. And one of the things that struck me really early on as an early career scholar, in fact, my very first conference paper after I had finished my PhD was on the topic of gender-inclusive language in biblical texts. Okay, now, at the time, some of you may remember this, in the early 2000s, there was a big debate going on in the evangelical world because the Zondervan, the publisher of the NIV, was publishing a new version of the NIV called the TNIV, Today's New International Version. And Today's New International Version use gender-inclusive language. It went back through that early English Bible, those translations that came out of the early modern era, which translated all of the words that talked about humanity as man. And it went back and they said, hey, look, not this isn't actually accurate. A lot of these references refer to both men and women. So let's go back and put men and women in the text. Well, there was a huge uproar over this. And in fact, there was a group of scholars who were so outraged by it that they got the rights to the RSV, the Revised Standard Version, and they produced a competing Bible to the TNIV, which they argued maintained the correct place of women in the Bible. Does anybody want to guess what that Bible was? The English Standard Version, the ESV. Okay, today it is one of the most popular Bibles that was out there, that is out there. And it was translated to combat what it saw, the evil influence of gender-inclusive language, it translated in the Bible. Now, this caught my funny. It's not so funny to me anymore, but it caught my funny in the early 2000s because as a medieval scholar, I knew that translating the Bible gender-inclusively had nothing to do with feminism because 15th century priests did it. Okay, and I've just given you a few examples here. I tell my students all the time, I don't even have to look for gender-inclusive language in medieval sermons and in medieval translations of biblical texts. It's just there. I see it almost. You just flip a manuscript page and it's there, okay? So very, very common. So I could spend the whole lecture talking about that gender-inclusive language, but I want to talk very briefly about an exemplar that I think really brings together this medieval idea of women, at least as what we find in 15th century sermon manuscripts, a place where you would not expect to find theology that treats women as equals. And the story I want to focus on is on the woman of Canaan. And this is a story that you can find in both the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Matthew. In Mark, she's called the Syrophoenician woman. In Matthew, she's called the Canaanite woman, which I think is a specific choice of words on Matthew's part, but I can tell you more about that in questions if you want to. And what we find in the story of the woman of Canaan, for those of you who don't know the story or you're trying to read the Middle English that's up here, this is the story of the woman who follows Jesus, calling for him to heal her daughter. That her daughter is ill and she's following Jesus, and Jesus turns to her and the disciples say, you know, stop this woman, she's making so much noise. And Jesus turns to the woman and says, you know, why should I take the bread that's for my children and give it to the dogs? Okay. He uses a racial slur in that text and calls this woman, and the woman responds back to him. And essentially says that she too deserves to partake of that bread. And Jesus says, woman, you are of great faith. Okay? Now, I don't know how you've heard this sermon preached, but in the medieval world, this was one of the most popular sermon stories. We find it even quoted in popular medieval literature like the Canterbury Tales, as well as by Christine de Pizan. And what we find in the narrative, the medieval narrative of the woman of Canaan, is we find that Jesus, that medieval clergy, when they heard this story and taught it to their parishioners, they taught that the woman of Canaan, that not only was she a Gentile, but that she was a woman. And that Jesus, by choosing this woman and telling her she was of great faith, that this woman was then an exemplar for all Christians. In fact, you can see at the bottom of the slide here, it says, this woman whose daughter was travailed with the fend is understood to be every man and woman whose soul, will, and conscience is in deadly sin. Okay? I can't tell you how common it is for women to be used as exemplars for men in medieval sermons. You think about sermons today that we hear, and we mostly hear we often don't hear examples about women, but in the medieval world, we did. So the woman of Canaan is an exemplar for all Christians. The woman of Canaan is also an exemplar of clergy. This is just absolutely fantastic that she is used. You can see in the manuscript below, Longleat Manuscript 4, it quotes Paul and it says, "Who is sick and I am not sick? Who is slandered and diseased and I am not burned with his disease?" All the busyness of this woman was to deliver her daughter from the fiend. So should prelates, preachers, and curates be about delivering men's souls, just like this woman who prayed for her daughter. And perhaps the most astounding passage that I have found in medieval sermons, one of my favorite passages that really emphasizes how women are seen in medieval theology, is following the story of the woman of Canaan. The Longleat manuscript then turns to Mary Magdalene and says this, "Mary Magdalene was the first messenger of life and of Christ's resurrection to the apostles who had fallen from the faith in his passion. And so she was the first who confessed and brought them again to the faith. And she was the first who preached the faith in France and the new law that the blame of Eve is turned to bliss and the sin of Adam is turned to happiness and our woe is turned to joy. Therefore, St. Paul says that the man of false belief should be saved by a woman of right belief." I'm not going to stand here before you and tell you the medieval world was not patriarchal, because it was. But in a world that taught that women's bodies were flawed and deformed, the church taught that women's souls were equal to men and also exemplars of the best of Christianity. I don't know what your church is like. I don't know what gender theology you have brought to this conference. But I want you to think about how evangelical gender theology is the exact opposite from the medieval world. In a world that tells us that women's bodies are human, often our churches tell us that women are less. And even if that is not your belief, and even as that is not your church, I guarantee you that you know women who have been impacted by this teaching of the church. And I just want to close with a few words from a letter that a woman sent to me. I get letters from women all over the world. This one was particularly poignant because I got it very shortly after the Making a Biblical Womanhood released, and it was from a woman in China. And her professor sent it to me. He reached out to me on every social media platform he could, trying to get a hold of me. And he told me, he said, "This book meant so much to her. I want you to hear her words." And this is what she said. She said, "When I was reading your book, I was crying through every chapter. It's such a shocking realization how deeply patriarchy has poisoned the worldview of Christians. It has turned Christianity into a weapon against women. I found that I had lost the joy of finding Jesus in my life. I took in the headship of men and persuaded myself that I was the problem. But now I know that Jesus was for me and never against me. That Jesus is for women, and I have found my Jesus again." So thank you, and I'll take questions now.
Thanks for that fascinating piece of history. I don't want you to give a long answer to this group about that. If we can take it up another time, maybe, if you'll be around later today. But the essence of my question is technical for history stuff. These, not the sermons, but the translations of the Bible that you were showing us, as far as you can tell, who is making them and how are they getting there? Are they using the Vulgate, or are there enough people in Northern Europe in the 15th century who can read Greek? That seems so, to be
no.
Tough.
I can answer that, and I'll also point you towards. I have an article coming out about the. Actually, it just came out in a volume about the Reformation and the Bible, and it's about the medieval Bible, and what. In the medieval world, people had access to vernacular translations of the Bible. I know we don't know this in our modern world, but they were actually pretty common. And so what those medieval clergy are using is they're either translating from the Vulgate because that was the most common translation. And in fact, I use the KJV up there because it is the closest to the medieval Vulgate. And so it's easy for people to recognize, so I don't have to put the Latin. But it's the KJV is a cheat sheet for the Vulgate. So they were using the Vulgate, or they were using actually a Middle English translation of the Bible that's similar to the Wycliffeite. In fact, we know that the Wycliffeite Bible translations were not considered heretical because ordinary clergy used them. And so they were also using the Wycliffeite text, and they were, which was mostly taking the Vulgate, and they would translate within the sermons. When they preached those sermons to ordinary people, they would translate the Bible gender inclusively. So yeah, that's a quick answer. I can talk more about it.
Hi, I'm Charlotte. I'm an incoming graduate student in historical theology, and I've done some work with female martyrdom texts. And as women as exemplars of the faith, I think of like Blandina, Perpetua, Felicitas.
Yeah.
And I was curious, in your research with these medieval manuscripts, is that a tradition that you've seen continued? Is there any connection there? I'd just love to hear you speak a little bit more about that.
Oh, I have a whole spreadsheet of all of the women of faith that are found in medieval sermons. Yes, women are, in fact, I would argue that in medieval sermons, we find what I would call gender parallelism, which is also something we see in the Gospel of Luke, where it tells a story about a man, then it tells a story about a woman. Medieval sermons are really good about doing that. They tell a story about a man and they tell a story about a woman. And a lot of these stories, you know, they tell these saints' lives, these stories of these powerful women of faith are something that all people would have heard frequently preached. And just also to let you know, medieval people heard a lot of preaching, okay? Preaching was not an invention of the Reformation world. It was very common. In fact, sometimes people went to multiple sermons a week. They were more attentive to sermons than we are today. Okay, so I'll just throw that out there. So yes, they heard these stories all the time, and I think that's part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Hey, over here.
Thank you very much, first of all.
You're welcome.
Second, in Genesis, when God created man, in his image, male and female, he created them and called them man. And we, the church, are called repeatedly the bride of Christ, a very feminine role. So I was wondering if you could comment, please, on if we don't have that representation of both men and women in the body, are we presenting a false image of what God is like to the world?
Yes. I think I'd answer that really fast. Yes, I think we are. I think I'll quote John Piper, who says that Christianity has a masculine feel. And I think that's one of the most dangerous statements that has been made in the modern church, because I think it creates a false representation of God as well as a dangerous representation for both women and men about who God is.
Over here.
Hi. So I am not a medieval scholar by any means, but I am learning how to speak Icelandic, and I couldn't help but notice that you had there were some letters in there that seemed
the
like
thorn.
They were,
they were
pulled from, you know, this kind of Icelandic culture, and we all know that Iceland is kind of an exemplar in the world for gender equality. Do you have a comment about how that may have, this legacy may have affected this kind of inclusive text?
So those letters, I left those in there. The thorn is, of course, one of the most common ones. But this is because English, Middle Old and Middle English were both influenced by Germanic influences, which is also what we see moving up into, you know, if you think about in the Danelaw region in England, that of course is from Scandinavia, and that influence back and forth. So this is just they're trading their language back and forth. And English, we know, is one of the most it is a compilation of all sorts of other languages, which is why it doesn't make a lot of sense to people who don't speak English. And so that's what it is. So this is, I would say that this is not, it's not directly an Icelandic, you know, moving in. It's this Germanic influence that is moving both ways. Okay. So, yeah.
Thank you. You referenced complementarianism as being a modern invention, mm-hmm. just like we
1986.
A lot of us, Yes, which is right when I was going to college and graduating high school and seeing it in the church, and was one of the reasons I left evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Can you say why or what was going on that was really starting to get that to infiltrate the church?
Why complementarianism was created, or why?
Why it started spreading and becoming kind of tied up into political.
Gosh. That's a whole book. But I can give you a short answer. One of the short answers is, and we see this throughout, you know, if you think about the history of women in the U.S. and you think about the fight to get the vote, and at moments when women achieve more legal equality, et cetera, like that, we also often see a pushback against that. So you can think women get the right to vote right before, before World War II, in that interim period between World War I and World War II. And then we see after World War II, there is this backlash to all of these women who have moved into the workplace and all of these women who have moved out into the job force. And we start seeing things like when women get married, they get fired. When women get pregnant, they get fired from their jobs. And the argument is that men need to be the breadwinners. And so we see this cultural push to move women out of the workplace and men into these breadwinning positions. And so then in the 1960s and 70s, we see that women start again to gain more ground. We see this is where it now becomes illegal for you to fire a pregnant woman or a woman who just got, or, you know, theoretically illegal to fire. And we find that women are able to move into education more. We also find that women get credit for the first time. They can take credit out in their own name without having to have a father or a husband co-sign for them. The Equal Opportunity Credit Act and all of these types of things start happening. And so we see women once again, and we also see, and this is the kicker, and I talk about this more in my next book, we also see women moving extensively into seminaries. In the 60s and the 70s, this is something across, we see more women moving into theological education. Even in Southern Baptist seminaries, women are moving in force in theological education. And then we see this pushback and pushing again this, a very clear, and in fact, I would argue that the modern gender theology that we would describe as complementarianism today, that argues that women are called to follow male leadership, although there's variations of it, it is one of the most restrictive gender theologies in Christian history. And I can stand and say that as a Christian historian.
And it's new?
It's new. 1986, 1987 is when they met together and they founded the... the term actually starts in the 1970s. There's an early 1976 article that I think uses the term. They took the term, and this was part of their discussions. It's in the records. They thought people responded negatively to patriarchy, so they created a better term. And it's a term they actually took from the Enlightenment era. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who argued that women are complement men, and that means that women are intellectually and biologically inferior to men. And that's the word that they use to create complementarian theology, which I find really ironic.
Yeah, I'd like to just comment. I'm Paul Carr, and I prayed for a son, but God gave me five daughters. But I am thankful that one of them was recently ordained as an Episcopal priest a few years ago. That never would have happened without people like you speaking out, but I'd like to also, just for your comment, and remind people that there's a scriptural reference in the Gospel of Luke, and it says, according to Luke, several women supported Jesus and his ministry out of their own money, food, and property.
Yeah.
And these are listed: Mary the Magdalene, Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager, and Susanna.
Yeah, no, it's women's leadership in the New Testament. I mean, I've learned a phrase here, settled science. I really like that phrase. I'm going to start using that phrase a lot. It is settled science that women were leaders in the New Testament church. I can say that. And it's really hard for me to understand how that is so resisted, because the evidence is so clear in both biblical text as well as in historical evidence.
I read a
book recently. I think it was called The North Sea, but it's sort of about the cultural history of the countries around the North Sea. One of the things it pointed out was that a very difference in marriage customs between, say, you know, the low countries or England versus, yeah, like, say, Italy or something during that period. And it was really influenced by the culture. I'm just curious if you had done much study on this kind of inclusiveness or whatever in other medieval cultures other than England.
Yeah, yeah. So I teach European women's history at Baylor from the ancient world all the way up through the modern world. So yes, indeed. And one of the things, like, for example, what I have just described, this phenomenon in Middle English sermons, is also a phenomenon in Middle French sermons, something very similar that we see going on there. We also see, you know, if you think, and also in Italy, actually, you know, one of my favorite scholars who I'm bringing to Baylor in August is a woman named Carolyn Musick. And all of her scholarship focuses on women preachers in Italy. And, you know, preachers who were so powerful that they influenced, that the popes came to them for advice. And this, again, is a settled part of Christian history. Yeah.
I found ministering in the local church in the science faith space that oftentimes talking about a scientific view on an issue, a theological view on an issue, and then a pastoral pathway forward. Can you give us any help on the pastoral level on how to deal with this, given that many evangelical churches, mm-hmm, probably most, are not aware of most of what you've said today?
Yeah.
How to move forward?
Yeah, I think I really love the statement of this organization, which emphasizes listening, and even what Francis Collins, the advice that he gave us last night. The reason people believe this is because this is what we have been taught. And this is what generations of Christians, especially now for over five generations now, this has been one of the primary teachings that has been moving into evangelical churches. So I actually have a lot of grace for people who believe differently on this topic. Because I understand why they believe it. When you read an ESV Bible, you are going to walk away with the idea that women cannot be leaders in the church, and that was intentional. There's a lot of scholarship on the ESV that I can point you towards. So I think the first thing is having a lot of grace, and I think having resources and just engaging people in conversations. Like when they ask you, when they say, well, women can't preach, and you're like, really? Why? Why? Where do you get that from? And they'll show you, you know, 1 Timothy 2. And then you can be like, wow, have you ever looked at Romans 16? Let's go look at Romans 16. How do we reconcile these two passages? They may not walk away agreeing with you, but hopefully they will walk away thinking. Like, hey, if the Bible, if I'm so certain about this here, that women can't be leaders, then what does it mean that Paul is commending women leaders? How do I reconcile those two things? So I would say have grace. Evangelicals, point to the Bible. There's plenty of scriptural evidence that women, you know, in fact, I think one of my favorite scholars about the Bible is a woman, about the New Testament, is a woman named Susan Hyland. And Susan Hyland wrote a great book about Phoebe. And what she argues, she says, the Bible is patriarchal. It was written in a patriarchal world. But what is also amazing about the Bible is that there are still, even within this patriarchal world, we see women leading and being lifted up within the church. They are both present, which means that you cannot say that the Bible says women cannot be leaders because women are leaders in the Bible, okay? So they are both there, and we need to recognize that. So maybe a little bit of help.
Okay, our last question.
How do you reconcile, or how do you process the scripture in Genesis of Eve's punishment that says your desire will be to the man and he will rule over you?
Yeah. So in the Making of Biblical Womanhood, I actually tell the story about when I was struggling with that passage. And one of the things that I now know is I was taught that, and in fact, this was one of the controversies with the ESV, is they actually tried to changed this in the Genesis text, where that verse said, instead of my desire, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you, it says your desire will be contrary to your husband and he will rule over you. And so, I mean, that's a really insidious change, which argues that the problem is not, that the sin is not patriarchy, because if you read this, I mean, actually part of the curse is patriarchy. Your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. This is not God's best, which is what scholars argue. It's like, why are we living in the sin? Why are we living in the curse? So the ESV changes that, where the sin, instead of the sin being patriarchy, the sin is women resisting patriarchy. Your desire will be contrary to your husband, yet he will still rule over you. And so, I mean, I think the explanation for patriarchy is that we live in a fallen world. And one of my statements that I still remember writing this in the Making of Biblical Womanhood, is I wrote, you know, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing Christians that oppression is godly. And I think that's what's happened in the conversations about women and men, if we have been convinced that the oppression of women is godly.
Thank you, Beth. Let's thank her for...